Software Engineering Radio, episode 118, Ilko Vischer on parsers.
This is Software Engineering Radio, the podcast for professional developers on the web at se-radio.net. SE Radio brings you relevant and detailed discussions and interviews on software engineering topics every 10 days. Thanks to our audience and the partners listed on our website for support.
Welcome wherever you are. My name is Lawrence Tratt. Today we're at the Code Generation Conference in Cambridge and my guest is Ilko Vischer. We're going to be talking today about parsing. So I'm just going to let Ilko do a quick little introduction, tell you where he's from.
Hi, Laurie. So my name is Ilko Vischer. I work at Delft University of Technology, which is in the Netherlands, and I'm an associate professor there, and I head a group of PhD students and postdocs doing research into language engineering, software configuration management, and stuff like that.
Okay, so a lot of our listeners will have heard about parsing. They'll know that parsing goes on somewhere. It's this magical term. So could you give us a sort of an introduction to parsing? You know, why we want to do it, what it roughly it does, and we'll go into more detail as we go along.
All right. So the general idea of parsing is that you have typically a textual representation. You have a text in some language, and you want to do some processing on that. So you want to get at the structure of the text and the structure underlying the text. And so typically you write a program that's reads the characters of the text and makes sense of it, makes a structured representation of that.
So is this a little bit, you know, with natural language, where implicitly when we talk, we sort of break apart a sentence, this is the verb, the noun, and that sort of thing, the subject?
Exactly. So that's actually called parsing in natural language linguistics theory, right? I mean, parsing is from dividing sentences up into parts and then making little tree structures for that. So that's exactly what parsing is about. But there are also all kinds of places in the computing where you do it. So think of a text file with lines and where you have kind of columns separated by tabs or colons or something like that, and you want to get the elements from the columns. And you would write a little program that gets the elements from the columns by reading the characters and seeing where the divisions are and translate it into some kind of tabular form.
So even, you know, breaking up a CSV file is a parsing of a sort.
Exactly.
Okay. So where are the sort of places that, I mean, that's obviously giving us quite a wide range. What are the sort of places where a typical user is going to be using parsing, maybe even if they don't know about it?
Well, exactly all those places, right? I mean, so even, reading in a string from a form in a web application. Right, and you have to see whether it's actually a correct sentence according to whatever you want in that place in a form. That's recognition, right? So you want to say, well, this string should comply with this particular language. It should look like this. It should be an email address, so it should have a bunch of letters and an at symbol, and then a bunch of other letters and a dot and some more and stuff like that. And so that's already a place where you might come across parsing problems.
Okay, and obviously people are probably often thinking about it in terms of things like compilers and that sort of thing. But as you're saying, it's used pretty much everywhere, wherever anyone is dealing anything with text that goes into a computer.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, so as I said earlier, a lot of our listeners and a lot of people in general will have the general feeling that parsing is a pretty hard topic. It's one of those things that people often run away in fear.
Why is that?
Well, that's kind of why I'm want to ask you. Since why is this something that people are often and scared of? Is it because there's a lot of technical terms associated with it, that it has a reputation? Maybe that, you know, with compilers and so on, there's a lot of scary tools, and we'll be getting into those later. Mm-hmm. But do you think it's just that people are often actually doing it themselves anyway? As you said, if they're breaking down CSV files or web page validation, they're doing parsing, and maybe they don't think of what they're doing. The simple thing is parsing.
Right, and then they may have come across Lex and Yak in their education and either understood that but thought it was quite difficult, or were too afraid of it to actually look at it. I don't know exactly, but so Lex and Yak is the Uber technology in this area, and it is a bit somewhat hard to use. But I'm not really sure about psychology because of this, because I'm quite happy and familiar using Parsing technology. I find it a bit hard to reason about why people would find it hard.
I would tend to agree with you. I think that perhaps a lot of people, there's a certain cultural thing that says it's hard without any necessarily a basis for it. But one of the reasons for that might be that if we go back to the example of a web page validation, let's imagine I've got a date form, and someone can type in a date in US format, British format, ISO format, whatever. There's all these various date formats. But so a lot of that sort of parsing, it's sort of a little bit of hand hackery often, they'll break things apart. Right. Can we do all types of parsing in using that technique?
Right. Of course. You can, if you have a general purpose programming language, you can implement any parsing problem that you want, right? The only problem is that at some point it becomes very unpleasant doing it yourself. And then you would rather like to use some higher level abstractions, a domain specific language.
How unpleasant would you say? Are we talking about impractical, or that there's a lot of corner cases that don't tend to be done correctly?
Well, it just becomes very tedious, right? You have to think of every step in the process. If you have read this character, then all these cases may occur. So basically, you have to build up a state machine with transitions, and you have to think of all the cases. And that is very tedious and easy to get wrong.
Mm-hmm. So another thing that a lot of people will often use is regular expressions. Most languages now have a reasonable regular expression support in, and regular expressions are relatively powerful. Is that enough to do all of this parsing stuff with? Does that solve some of my problems?
Well, so definitely some of these input form validation problems, or even these CSV files. Parsing those things, you can get a long way with regular expression and Perl programming and that kind of stuff. Regular expressions are another way to do parsing. It's it's the next level up from parsing manually. Writing your own parsing program completely. And regular expressions are nice because it's a formal language that declaratively describes a little language, right? The structure of a little language. But it's not enough. The problem with regular expressions is that they cannot deal with recursion. So as soon as you have a language that has some kind of parentheses, right, where you have expressions that have parentheses, and then within those parentheses you can have another expression with parentheses, so you have kind of nested expressions, then, we know from formal language theory that regular expressions don't do the job.
So in other words, it's the problem that they can't balance things out. If there's an open bracket here, but two open brackets, they can't sort of count in the sense that there should be two at the end.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a fairly good reason then why. So regular expressions get me further in a sense, or allow me to do more, but they still hit a buffer.
Right, so in technical terms, a regular expression you can implement using a state machine, a finite state machine, right? So you have, after reading a character, you have to decide which state to go next, and the only thing you have to remember is which state you are in. And the problem with these parentheses languages is that you have to you need a stack machine, because you need to remember where you have been.
Okay, so you end up manually coding extra stuff on top, as well as using the regular expressions again. So we're kind of back to the manual process again, effectively, but extra help.
With pure regular expression, you cannot do it. But then, if you have some way of calling regular expressions and then you using defining them by functions or something like that, and then you can emulate so you can basically use the stack of the function call stack to emulate this stack, and then you can get this nested behavior.
Okay, so then we move on to the sort of the tools that people know about, but before we get there, there's obviously this is why academics start getting involved. There's a whole theory of parsing, of formality and so on. So could you give us an idea of, you sort of mentioned about state machines and so on, and could you give us an idea of what the underlying theory, in a sense, I mean, not going into too much detail, perhaps, but of parsing that solves the problems that you've talked about, the regular expressions, can't balance brackets, and so on.
Right. So this goes back to the 50s, and to linguistics even, so to the study of natural language. So Noam Chomsky in America was studying natural languages, and he came up with a hierarchy for describing, formalizing language grammar. So people had been thinking about grammars, but Chomsky came up with a formal system to describe languages. So he came up with this idea of context-free grammars. The idea there is that you have a symbol, so-called null terminal, and you have productions, and productions can rewrite symbols. So basically, it was a system for doing string rewriting. So his systems were not for parsing so much as they were for describing the generation of language. So they were generative grammars.
So they could recognize that something was valid, as you say?
No. They could generate the valid sentences of a language. So the idea of context-free grammar, so if you look at the context-free grammar, you write it as a symbol, arrow, mm-hmm. a bunch of other symbols. And the idea was that you start with the start symbol, and then you could look at the rules of the grammar, and those rules said, well, if you have the symbol S, then you can replace it with the symbol noun followed by verb. And then noun you could replace by this and that.
So it's describing the valid sentences that I can build.
So, I mean, exactly. So it's a generator for the language rather than...
So this is like the implicit rules that, you know, we all learned from our parents listening to them speak when we grow up, that we know that sentences, you know, have a noun and a verb and a subject and so on, that, and right. we have those rules implicitly.
Right. Well, so Chomsky's program was really, can we understand how language works? And his theory was that actually our mind somehow uses such kinds of rules to describe how we generate sentences. Of course, so there's a debate about whether that actually works for natural language. And so in addition to these context-free grammars, you came also up with context-sensitive grammars, where you say, well, if you have this symbol in the context of some other symbols, then you can rewrite it to this set of symbols.
Ah, so in other words, the actual specific content of a word changes what I can say afterwards. So let me rephrase that. With the context-free grammars, it doesn't matter. I can put any random words in, provided they obey the structure correctly.
Right.
But with the context-sensitive, if I say... dog, then I have to say bark. I can't say meow or moo or
something like that. Yes,
I'm simplifying.
Yeah.
So how does this then relate to computing parsing? So you said this is
right. So then in the early 60s, people were working on ALGOL 60. So this was a domain specific language for defining algorithms. Right. I mean, that was the problem at of the time. And they wrote, so they tried to formalize the design of that language, and so they had a report about it, and so they came up with this formalism called the EBNF, well, BNF actually, so called Beckes-Naur form, and Beckes and Naur kind of independently, I remember, came up with this formalism for describing grammars, which was basically equivalent to Chomsky's context-free grammars, and so they use these rules to describe the syntax of ALGOL, and that gave rise to a whole lot of work in research about defining languages.
So the original definition of ALGOL 60, this was saying what the valid syntax was, but at that point it was still a sort of a paper thing, in a sense. It hadn't been tooled necessarily, or not originally. It was thought of a way as just saying, here is the valid syntax of ALGOL 60.
Right, it was a description language, a specification language.
So we mentioned earlier about BNF, Beckes-Naur form, and we also mentioned EBNF. So could you just give listeners a brief idea what the difference, but what does the E do, as
right.
it were?
So the E stands for extended BNF. And so BNF is plain context-free grammar. So you have a symbol on the left-hand side and a bunch of symbols on the right-hand side, and you basically can expand symbols. And so now there are typical patterns in grammars that you would like to write down a bit more concisely. So one typical example is list. So you want to have a list of expressions separated by commas, typically, right? In a context-free grammar, you would have to define a non-terminal expression list and then say, well, an expression list is either either empty or it can be an expression followed by a comma followed by an expression list. And so that's kind of a typical pattern that you have to write over and over again. And so what EBNF does is provide a higher level construct to allow you to define those things. So typically in EBNF, you can write expression star for a list of expressions.
Zero to many, just like in regular expressions. If
exactly. So basically it adds regular expression operators to grammars.
And this is basically just a nice syntactic convenience because there's this repeated tedious idiom that you had to go over, and this allows you to nicely...
Right. I mean, you can define a simple transformation that transforms EBNF grammars to basic BNF grammar.
So from an expressive power point of view, there's no difference between the two, just EBNF is a lot more pleasant to work with.
Right.
What comes next? If I've got a description of a language, how can I be familiar with tools like Flex and Yak and maybe even Java CC and so on? And they know that they write some sort of context-free grammar, and they'll, you know, they're probably even aware of the traditional syntax where there's a little one term on the left-hand side, then there's an arrow, and then there's some stuff on the right-hand side, and that magically they feed this into one of these tools, and then it'll generate some code for them that then reads in a text file and does some magical stuff for them. So could you maybe give us an idea of, you know, what are the inputs to these tools? The languages, are they context-free grammars in general? And what is the typical output of a tool? I mean,
So the basic idea is that you write a context-free grammar and feed it to a tool. Then there are basically two classes of tools, divided into top-down parsers and bottom-up parsers. And both these classes take a restricted subset of the full set of context-free grammar. So the idea of a top-down parser is that it starts with the start symbol and then says, well, okay, so here are a number of productions, and I can my sentence should start with should consist of one of these productions. So I'm going to look at the leftmost symbol of all these productions and I can try to see whether the first word in my string matches the first word in one of these productions.
So a production is an individual rule in the grammar, should we say? Yep.
Yes. And then it goes on, and so if it decides, well, this production you should take, and then it says, well, next we expect this symbol, and we're going to look at the production of that, and then eventually you have a complete tree. The problem with top-down parsers is that they cannot deal with left recursion. For instance, imagine a production where you have an expression E can be an expression E followed by the symbol plus followed by another expression.
So in other words, if I do the standard calculator grammar, you know, so I've got expression plus expression or expression minus expression, expression star expression, yeah, standard simple mathematics, that can't be expressed in
exactly. So in when you just feed that into a top-down parser, such a grammar, then it will loop because it will say, well, okay, I need to recognize an expression. In order to recognize an expression, I'm going to, I have to recognize an expression. So it will infinitely loop and try to...
And it never makes any progress.
Right. Yep. And then you have bottom-up parsers, and those are, Yak is the prototypical bottom-up parser. The idea there is that you decide that if you want to recognize a string for a certain symbol, then you look at all productions and try to see if you can make progress with any of those productions, and maybe multiple. And then at some point you reach a point where you have reached the end of a production, and then you can actually say, well, now we can make a reduction, and we can say, well, we have recognized this part of the string corresponds to this production, and then you can go up one level.
Okay. So We've mentioned, you know, the classic tool. I mean, Yak is the one that we'll keep on coming back to probably. So a lot of these tools, they take in a grammar file, and whether it be at the top-down or bottom-up parser, and a lot of people will be familiar with them generating a whole load of code. They, you know, you feed them in and magically it generates a C file or a Java file or something. Is that sort of an intrinsic part of the way a parser needs to work? Or why are they doing this?
Well, so essentially what happens is that a parser generator transforms a grammar into a decision machine, a state machine, and the state machine then keeps track of if the parser is in this state and you see this character in the input or this token in the input, then go to this state, and that's how these things work. And that's what we were discussing before, right? So you can write these state machines by hand by making if then else statements and stuff like that, but you want to avoid that. And the clever thing of parser generators is that they do generate that state machine for you.
So when they generate all this stuff, so that's a sort of an intrinsic part of what they do. But one of the things that, you know, if anyone's ever looked at the file that say Yak generates, there's an awful lot of stuff in there. Presumably it could have just done that at runtime, but by doing it in advance, it's able to pre-compute all this. This is the presumably the interesting thing, right?
Right. So the process of transforming the grammar into a state machine is often an expensive process. So you want to pre-compute that. At least, if you get large grammars, this can be quite an expensive process, especially if you have these LR parser generators with lots of look ahead, then these tables become huge. So you want to definitely do that offline. But then the other issue is, so the essential part of this is that you compute the state machine, and then you could have some representation of that. So you could put the state machine in an XML file and then read the XML file in at runtime and interpret it. And that is, so the fact that parser generate code is not really essential. I mean, you could generate a parser, well, so yeah, you need the representation of the state machine, and then you can interpret that somehow, or you can generate code that executes the state machine transitions, but that is a matter of engineering, basically.
Okay. I think that will be quite interesting to a lot of people. As I said, it's often just a sort of a cultural expectation they generate code. So it's right. Good that we're
so clear. So, for instance, the SDLR parser that's used by SDF, the grammar formalism that I've worked on, it actually interprets a file that encodes the state machine. And it doesn't, so you don't have to generate a parser for each language. You can just read it in at runtime. But the computation of the state machine, that is the expensive part, and you want to
just do that once, effectively.
Yep. Basically.
Okay. The other thing that anyone who's used these tools, so I've now, let's imagine I've got a Yak thingy, I've generated some code, or I'm reading it at runtime. So I've got a parser, and I give it some input. You know, the question is, what does it do next? We've sort of touched on this, that it builds a tree or something. So could you talk about what's often called semantic actions or parse trees and so on?
Right. So then the question is, so you have this grammar, you can recognize, so the basic thing that a parser does for you is recognize sentences, right? So for instance, you could use it in a web application and recognize that the input of your form is actually correct according to the syntax of the language. And then, so you could indeed make a parser for dates, right? But next, you probably want to actually use the structure, right? I mean, we talked through this in the beginning. You actually want to have the structure of the text so that you can do further processing. So there's an intrinsic correspondence between a grammar provides a structure for sentences, a natural tree structure, and so if you look at a context free grammar, let's look at this expression grammar. So you have an expression plus an expression is another expression, an expression times expression is an expression. So now if you read the sentence A plus B times C, then the natural tree representation is, you have a plus node with an A as a child, and you have a times node, which is a child of this plus node, and it has children C and D, B and C probably. Mm-hmm. So what you could let a grammar or a parser do is build this tree structure. So, for instance, the SDF formalism that I talked that I mentioned before does exactly that. So, when you parse a string with that parser, it will build a tree structure, a term representation of the text that you have parsed, and then you can use it as an input for further processing.
So, this is what a lot of people call a parse tree, right?
That's right.
And so, can you some parsers automatically create this parse tree, and sometimes some parsers you can either create it manually or you don't even necessarily have to. So, for example, the YAC type family has this semantic action, and
exactly.
You see this slightly artificial example, perhaps, where they have the calculator grammar and they actually automatically add numbers up and multiply.
Right. So the original philosophy in compilers in the 70s was, well, you didn't have a lot of memory and you should really parse a program, and immediately when you were parsing, you should compile it to machine code, and so you have a single linear sweep of your program that should do everything at once, because that was easier, because you didn't have to read in the whole program in memory, because there just wasn't that much memory, so you really had to optimize for those kinds of things. And so you see that languages in those days were designed for this. For instance, Pascal was designed so that all definitions became for before uses, right? So, and that was a design in order to enable this kinds of processing. You parsed the your program, and then immediately you could compile it. And now, so parser formalisms were also designed in such a way that you could actually, rather than building up a tree, so there's this natural tree underlying the grammar, you would actually perform semantic actions as a result of recognizing a production. So then you would attach to a production a so-called semantic action, and which basically was a statement in your host programming language. So YAC used C, and you could execute a bit of C code there, and where you can, and then, well, there was access to the stack. So you could actually access the children of the trees, and then so one way to use this is actually to, in those semantic actions, build up a tree that you then could later process. But you could also do immediately perform semantic evaluation. So you mentioned the expression calculator. That's a standard example in compiler course where you would, instead of build the tree plus AB, you would actually compute plus the value of A and the value of B.
Okay, so I mean, I think what we're effectively saying there is that back in the day, I mean, parsing was a very expensive activity in computation and memory terms. So there was a lot of effort to try and make this whole thing efficient. So, for example, parse trees. If you parse a whole load of text, build a big tree, it's expensive. So we try and do things as we go along. Now that maybe also brings us to a lot of the thing. One of the reasons I think why parsing scares people is there's a load of these weird terms, LL, LR, LALR, and so on. So can you give us maybe a little idea of the history? Why are they there are these various terms? Maybe if we can explain some of the major ones just briefly at a sort of high level.
Right. So before I mentioned top-down parsing and bottom-up parsing, so these are the fundamental ways to do parsing. And so for instance, in top-down parsing, you say, well, which we should decide on the production to take by looking at the first symbol. So basically what you were doing there is so look at the first symbol in the input and then try to match that against the symbols in the left hand side of the production. And or you could have a bit of more look at, and so that is called LL parsing. And LL1 is where you have a look at of one, and LL2 is where you have a look at of two tokens.
So that means that it's not that I look ahead two things in the grammar, I look ahead two things in the input.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And you would actually do a bit of a computation to see if the which tokens were predicted by symbols in the production.
So maybe this is a point actually we should be explicit of one again, not maybe another one of the things that a lot of these parsing out approaches have given us implicitly and we don't think about explicitly. We've mentioned tokens and non-terminals. So all of these parsing things, they're actually based on a sort of a two-phase structure, aren't they?
That's right.
The first or typically they were, the first stage being I break stuff up into words. You know, in simple, if I look at English, for example, it's just a word is separated by space, so I just break everything up. So those are the tokens, and you also called those non-terminals.
No, no. So the tokens are the words indeed. So things like plus and an identifier, and those are the tokens. And the non-terminals are the symbols in your grammar. So things like expression and statement and for loop.
So those are the things that don't have a direct. They're not actually in the use input. Those are parts of the tree structure. So
exactly.
Okay. And so those two phases are separated. So this is why we have lex and yak, for example. Lex is doing that first, splitting the things up into words, and then yak is making the tree structure or the semantic
right.
actions or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Sorry. So we're going back to the. You've explained LL, so then we've got LR and LALR and those things. But again, maybe we can go over a little bit about those.
Mm-hmm. Right. So LR and LALR are variants used in generating decision tables for bottom-up parsers, shift-reduce parsers, and they are technical variations on deciding which class of grammars you can actually deal with in a parser generator.
So effectively these terms, what we're saying, if we go back earlier, we talked about context-free grammars, and I think it's fair to say for all computer languages, that most computer languages we're interested in, context-free grammars are what we want.
Yes, you would say so, but then people invent things like offside rules in Haskell or Python, which don't exactly, which you cannot express with context-free grammars.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get onto that later. So that's quite interesting. But all these funny symbol terms like LL and LA and LLR, LALR even, are really saying actually we're taking subsets of the context-free grammars. We're deliberately cutting down the number of things we can pass, presumably for efficiency reasons. Generally,
well, the issue is ambiguities, right? So in a top-down parser, you need to decide which way to go. And you can look a couple of tokens ahead, and then you can decide that. If you have to look too much ahead, then you're inspecting the string all the time. But for some grammars, there, for instance, these left recursive grammars, there's not enough tokens you can look at because there's not a fixed number of tokens you could look at to decide where to go, what to do. So they restrict, for top-down parsing, the grammar is restricted to be non-left recursive. So that's one example of a restriction to fit a particular approach to parsing.
And so we went back to the fact that a lot of this parsing stuff happened in the 1960s, and you know, computers were just a tiny little bit slower then. Is it the case that, you know, for example, So the LL type parsers have this obvious limitation, but with the LR parsers, they still don't allow me to express every context-free grammar. And again, presumably that is just because that allowed the very slow computers to pass text at a reasonable speed.
Well, it's not just slowness. It is about algorithmic complexity, because the early designed a parsing algorithm in the 60s called early parsing. And that actually can deal with all context-free grammars, well, maybe except for circular ones, but so it basically can deal with all context-free grammars. But the complexity of that algorithm is cubic. So it can take up to n to the third time to parse a string using an early parser.
So if I've understood that correctly, what we're saying there is early parsing, and that's early with an E at the end, as an E-A-R-L-E-Y, rather than just early in the morning. The algorithm, I mean, it's not necessarily that it's difficult to implement for the poor person who writes the parser. It's that the longer the input, potentially, it takes a cubic amount of time to parse. In other words, it can be very, very slow. And so when it was invented, on the computers of the day, that would have taken hours possibly to parse a relatively simple
right.
string for the calculator grammar, for example.
I mean, typically things get bad if you get longer string. Yeah. Mm. That is complexity, right? I mean, it doesn't scalability. It doesn't scale to large things.
So
this challenge was to have parsing algorithms that were linear, and LL and LR guarantee linearity for parsers.
So is this still a concern today? I mean, you know, the processor I have in my phone, for example, is 10 times the speed of the fastest supercomputer in the 1960s.
Right, but still, I mean, complexity beats everything, right? I mean, things go up fast. So it remains a concern. You don't want a exponential parsing algorithm or even cubic is you don't want to have that.
So is that why we're still using, for example, parsers with this LR stuff and LL and so on, that we're still, the efficiency is still worth us cutting down the amount of things we can easily pass just so we know we can do it very efficiently?
Well, so partly there are just tools around that are based on this stuff.
Okay.
They've proven their worth and they work. Another advantage of using these subsets is that if you succeed in fitting your grammar in this subset, in one of these subsets, then you're guaranteed that your grammar is non-ambiguous. So that's kind of ambiguity is a problem where you can parse a string in more than one way. But so you can say, well, it might be an expression, but it also might be a state. And that's typically not what you want when you define a language, because you want to be clear about what
is the classic type of ambiguity is if I have the expression 2 + 3 × 4. Now we implicitly expect that to be 2 + (3 × 4).
Right.
But a parsing algorithm thinks, well, I could either do that as 2 + (3 × 4) or the other one. And that's the sort of
that's an example of ambiguity indeed. Yeah, so depending on how you formulate this, the grammar may be ambiguous to parse those kinds of expressions, indeed.
Okay, so earlier we mentioned about parse trees. Now, there are two terms that often come up in parsing, which is parse trees and abstract syntax trees. Could you differentiate between them for us?
Sure. So a parse tree is a tree you get directly from parsing according to the grammar. So we talked about this production E is E plus E. And so the parse tree you would get from that is a node with label E, and it has three children, one labeled E, one labeled plus, and one labeled E. And even you may have white space in between, and you could have that in the parse tree as well.
So it still maintains, you know, the tokens, actually the original user's text is all somewhere in there.
Exactly.
Probably.
So you can exactly reproduce the string from the tree, right? So by just going over the tree and printing all the bits of text that are stored in a tree, and then you get your string back. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the parse tree and the string you have parsed.
Okay, so and then we have abstract syntax tree.
Right, so now, of course, this plus child of this node is not very interesting, because we know, what you do in abstract syntax trees is transform this parse tree to a tree where you label the nodes of the trees with the name of the production. So, for instance, we could use name the plus production plus, typically, and so then we could transform this E, this tree E with children E plus and E to a tree with in the roots label plus and as children two expression nodes. And we throw away the literal and also a white space and stuff, that because we typically don't need that for further processing.
So if I can try and repeat that back in another way, maybe. So if I've got a compiler, I do my first pass and I get back a parse tree which has got all of the bits of the text in there, but then that's quite low level. So then I'll typically have a phase which would create me an abstract syntax tree which will flatten the structure, throw away the bits of the user's input that are not relevant, that are just formatting related and so on, and just leave me with the essence really of what the user wanted to say.
Exactly.
Okay. And are there tools, are there ways of, how does one create an abstract syntax tree? Is it done by hand or?
Well, so some of these parsing formalisms, we talked about semantic actions a while ago. And there you see that, the user is actually in control of building the tree. So typically there you immediately build an abstract syntax tree rather than a parse tree. So there's not this two-stage processing. You just build an abstract syntax tree immediately. Other formalisms, but the disadvantage of that is that you actually have to do it, right? You have to build a structure, and you could actually derive this abstract syntax tree automatically from the grammar, because there's a one-to-one correspondence between grammar parse trees and abstract syntax trees. And so SDF is a formalism which was designed to do that. And so there's a one-to-one correspondence between parse trees and abstract syntax trees. And so there's a bit of there's an issue why you cannot do that with all kinds of grammar formalism, because in many grammar formalism you have to we talked about ambiguities earlier, and you have to disambiguate explicitly, and typically you do that for expressions, for instance, by having different levels of precedence which you encode as non-terminal symbols. So you have a level for multiplicative expressions and additive expressions, and these are different symbols. And then what you get is that you get so-called injection, so production that say, well, multiplicative expression is, an additive expression can be a multiplicative expression, or it can be a additive plus an additive expression. And then, so this injection from going from multiplicative to additive is kind of a tree. You will get a tree node with a single child in it, and you may have long chains of these injections, and that gives you that's often why you see that you want to have this mapping from parse tree to abstract syntax tree. So you not only throw out these literals and layouts, but you also flatten these injection chains, and so you have to maybe have to. So that's one thing. Another thing is that in some approaches you use iteration to express. So you can have a long row of E plus E plus E plus E, and that's then expressed as an iteration. But in a tree, you would rather like to have a nested tree structure, and then you have to do a transformation to get from that the list of expressions to the nested structure. And this is, for instance, a case where in top-down parsing formalisms where you cannot express left recursion. And now, so the idea of SDF was that it should be a formalism where the tree structure you get is really a one-to-one correspondence to the grammar formalism. So you're from the grammar, you know what your tree looks like, and in order to do that, it couldn't use these, you shouldn't use express precedence in the grammar, but you should, so you just have a production E is E plus E or E times E, and then you have separate disambiguation rules that tell you, well, this one is left associative and multiplication has higher precedence than addition. And so when you do that outside of the production rules, then you don't contaminate the production rules with this information, and you can actually get a nice, you see this, the tree structure in the grammar, basically.
So if I've got that correctly, so SDF is a way of fairly automatically creating or giving significant help in creating abstract syntax trees and deferring some of these decisions about precedence and so on until the sort of the second stage when you're creating that abstract syntax tree rather than when the parse tree is.
No. So the idea is not so that you. It's basically a separation of concerns issue. Right? So you can say, well, the grammar describes several things. One is the tree structure that you want to think about, but the logical structure of your language elements. And the other is, well, how should we parse these things? I mean, these expressions should be disambiguated. The operator should be parsed in a particular order. And so that you could see that as a separate concern, right? If you're writing a compiler, you're interested in the logical structure of your language, not so much in a disambiguation as kind of a parsing issue. And SDF allows you to do that separation of concerns by having a separate definition of disambiguation rule, but they are used within the parser. So the parser takes care that you don't get ambiguities, but you don't have to express it in the grammar. That's the.
So earlier we were talking about lex and yak, and we had these two very distinct phases of breaking the input up into tokens and then passing it. Now, I believe that you were one of the original people involved in scannerless parsing, where in a sense these two phases are somehow merged. Could you talk to us a little bit about that, please?
That's right. So I worked on this SDF formalism, which was designed to have a natural abstract syntax tree. And so what I did is, we used to have, before I started working on this, we had a traditional two-phase language definition. So the formalism did So in Lex and Yak, you have separate files for defining the lexical syntax and for defining the context tree syntax. In STF, you actually had a single formalism that allowed you to describe the lexical syntax and the context tree syntax. So it already integrated those issues, but the lexical syntax was still described using regular expressions and character classes, regular expressions, star and plus, and those kind of things. And so what I did is turn those, so just use regular, normal context tree grammars to define the lexical syntax rather than just regular expression. And throw away the scanner, basically. So rather than having a separate stage in which we tokenize the string, the parser reads characters, so the tokens of that are now the characters. And we use this context tree grammar to both do the scanning, so-called, and the parsing bit.
And so what advantage does that gain one? I mean, obviously it's nice squishing two faces into one, but does this give me some extra practical expressive power or efficiency or?
Yeah, so for instance, we talked earlier about the limitations of regular expressions, right? That you cannot express nested structures. So for instance, think of the problem of nested comments, right? So you have Java style long comments and you want to nest these things. That doesn't work because it stops at the, let's say if you comment opening symbol and then you have another comment opening symbol and then you have to comment close, corresponding to the second opening symbol, but that it will just stop there and stop parsing your comment. And using these, now using context tree grammars for lexical syntax, you can actually express things like nested comments. So that's a little nicety. I mean, it kind of generalizes the definition of lexical syntax from what we had before. And that was kind of the motivation sort of thing that I had in my thesis. So that was not a very strong story, I have to say. I mean, so there were a few small problems in Pascal that you could solve more nicely using this, but it was not really a killer application of scannerless parsing. So I didn't realize until much later that what the real killer application would be, and that is language combination. So the problem of combining languages is that you have to combine grammars. Let's first talk about why you want mm-hmm. would like to combine languages, right? I mean,
yes,
that'd be an interesting. So we're here at the code generation conference, and one of the what you do in code generation is generate code. Wow. So what you typically do is write templates that do code generation. So you have some kind of meta language, a template language, and you have a bit of language that you the quoted language, the stuff that you generate. Now, typical template engines use just generate text. I mean, they don't have any the templates don't have any structure, and that means that the templates are not checked syntactically. So you cannot you don't know if the template fragments, code fragments, are syntactically correct, and also you don't have the structure of the text you generate, and you cannot do any further processing on that. At least, well, you should have to parse after mm-hmm. generation, and that's kind of clumsy. So now using language combination, you can say, well, okay, we define a template language that is extended with, say, the language of the syntax of Java, so that we can actually parse the template fragments using the proper syntax of Java, and then we can syntactically check that these fragments are correct, and then we can also build and use the underlying abstract index tree to actually generate abstract index tree rather than text.
Before this was difficult because Lex and Yak effectively, those two phases were very distinct. I had to entirely take my text in and turn it into words, tokenize it, and then I would parse it. But if I've got two languages in a file, then they probably don't share the same tokenization rules, presumably, and that would make combining them very difficult. But if I'm using scannerless parsing, it can automatically say, oh, I've reached the Java bit, now I turn into the Java parser, as it were, and then I go back to the template language, I turn into the parser and scanner for that.
Right. So there's a bit of theoretical foundation for this. So the problem is that the context-free grammars are close to the composition. So if you take two context-free grammars and put them together, you have a new context-free grammar. But if you take a regular grammar, so the one that is used for defining the tokens of a language, regular grammars are not close in the composition, nor are subsets of the context-free grammar, such as LL, LL, or so LR.
Can we explain to our listeners what we mean by it's not closed under composition?
Right. So you take two lex files, mm-hmm. put them together. You don't have a new lex file.
It's an invalid file, probably.
It may not be a new valid lex file because it doesn't follow the restrictions of the language. Or it may actually be one, but because the rules have to be in some order, you may not get the tokenization that you want. I'd say that you may have, for instance, keywords of one language are identifiers in the other language, and then there would be reserved words, so you cannot no longer use those keywords of the other language as identifiers in your other language. And that is annoying. And so, for instance, so you say you have a template language, it has a keyword define, and in your Java program you want to use define as an identifier. Then if you make this combined grammar, then you couldn't generate a Java program with this keyword define in it because it's a keyword in the template language, and that's the sort of thing that is annoying. And now using this scannerless parsing, so the trick basically is that scanner is no longer the problem really with this combining scanners is that the scanner just goes over the string and sees, well, this should be an identifier or it should be a keyword without looking at the context of where you are in the file. And now if you do scannerless parsing, the parser basically steers the scanning, so the tokenization. It says, well, at this point I expect a Java identifier, and well, it will look for a Java identifier. And at some other point it will look at I'm expecting a template engine keyword, so you may have define here.
So is this a context sensitive grammar then? We mentioned
yeah,
this.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing, isn't it? A context-free grammar that does context.
It is still context-free.
It is context-free, but it still provides context. That's always a bit counterintuitive. So let's see if we can. No, you're right. I mean, so this is just it still is a context-free grammar, but so you do scanning in the context of a particular symbol.
So it maintains all the sort of the theoretical niceness of context-free grammars.
Exactly. Yep. Yes.
Okay. So, given that we're sort of moving into this future, possibly, where we're getting lots of domain-specific languages and we're embedding them in, scannerless parsing is probably a significant way of enabling this, something that was very difficult to do before. So do you see this as the sort of the killer application for scannerless parsing?
Absolutely, yes, yes. I mean, we have been doing really great things due to the fact that we had this scannerless parsing algorithm. So we've been embedding domain-specific languages into Java. We've been building code generation tools where we embed the source and target language into the meta language, so that we can parse fragments of those languages. I think you only get that right using something like scannerless parsing and the techniques underlying SDF.
Okay, excellent. Well, I would agree. It sounds like a really great way of moving things forward. I think probably be seeing an awful lot more scannerless parsing as we move into this sort of world. So I think that's probably something for everyone to keep an eye on. Ilka Vischer, thank you very much.
Thanks, Laurie. It was fun.
Thanks for downloading and listening to Software Engineering Radio. Software Engineering Radio is an educational program brought to you by Hillside Europe. If you want more information about the podcast and all the other episodes, visit our website at se-radio.net. If you want to support us, you can donate to the SE Radio team via the website, or you can advertise for SE Radio, for example, by clicking on the Dig, Reddit, Delicious, and Slashdot buttons. To contact the team, please send email to team@se-radio.net, or if it is specific to an episode, please use the comments facility on the website so other people can react to your comments. This episode of SE Radio, as well as all other episodes, are licensed under a Creative Commons 2.5 license. Please see the website for details. Thanks to Charlie Crow and the PodSafe Music Network for the music used in this show. The song is called Vegas Hard Rock Shuffle.